The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
Sports Talk 1240 is brought to you by DraftPot.com. DraftPot is changing fantasy sports. Sign up today at DraftPot.com with promo code SportsTalk1240 and receive a 100% deposit bonus up to $1,500. And now, Sports Talk 1240.
Well, good evening and hello again, everybody. Welcome to Hour 1 of Sports Talk 1240 on WGBB, Freeport, Long Island, New York. Bill Donahue taking you through the first hour on this Sunday night, the 25th day of October. Our engineer, Brian Graves, is across the way. We've got a great show lined up for you tonight. Up first, we'll welcome in the guitarist from the Allman Brothers and Government Mule, among his many other collaborations. The great Warren Haynes will join us. And in the second half, we'll talk to author Russ Cohen about his new book, Numbers Don't Lie, The Biggest Numbers in New York Mets History. So sit back and relax and enjoy Sports Talk 1240 tonight on GBB. We've got some great stuff ahead in the next few hours. As always, before we begin, I invite you to follow us on our Facebook page, cleverly titled Sports Talk 1240. There you'll find sports information, show information, and more. So stop by, give us a look, and then you can press that button and give us a like. You can also follow us on Twitter at SportsTalk1240, and all past shows can be heard on our website at www.SportsTalk1240.com. Well, my first guest is a rock and blues guitarist, vocalist, and songwriter, best known for his work as the longtime guitarist with the Allman Brothers Band and a founding member of Government Mule. Early in his career, he was a guitarist for David Allan Coe and the Dickie Betts Band. He's also known for his associations with the members of the Grateful Dead, including touring with Phil Lesh and his friends, and the Dead. He's got a new album out entitled Ashes and Dust. I welcome to Sports Talk 1240 tonight, Warren Haynes. Warren, good evening.
How are you?
Great to have you with us tonight, Warren.
My pleasure.
Now, let's talk a little bit about the weapon that you use. Your primary guitar is a Gibson Les Paul. It's a 58 reissue.
Well, I used to 58 reissues and 58, 59 reissues, and eventually Gibson and I collaborated on a signature model that's kind of mixing the two together. And so there's an actual Warren Haynes signature model Les Paul out there now.
Super. Okay. Now that's built to your specs.
Yeah, I really like it. It's the 59 neck, 58 body, and some other custom stuff that we came up. It's the most comfortable guitar for me.
Beautiful. Now, explain to us, Warren, give us an idea of your early influences in music.
Well, I started singing first when I was about 7 or 8, and I was mostly listening to soul music. James Brown was my first hero. I love the Four Tops and the Temptations and Sam and Dave and Wilson Pickett and Otis Redding. A few years later, when I heard Jimi Hendrix and Cream and Johnny Winter, that made me want to pick up a guitar, which is somewhere around age 11. I studied everything I could get my hands on. I would read interviews by all my favorite guitar players and see who they listened to, and then go backwards and discover a lot of the blues giants and jazz giants that I had not heard prior. And, you know, it's like a family tree. You just keep kind of seeing where it all leads you.
Sure. We're talking to Warren Haynes tonight. You really have to enjoy and remark about the blues influence about your former employer, David Allan Coe. Talk a little bit about how the blues influenced David.
Well, when he first called me, I told him I was 19, and I knew very little about him or his music, and I knew that he was kind of a country artist. And I said, well, I'm not really a country guitar player, and I'm not interested in unless I can play like myself. And he explained to me that he was looking for a blues rock guitar player to add an edge to his music. I soon found out that he loved Lightnin' Hopkins and T-Bone Walker and Jimmy Reed. So sometimes when we would go on stage, we might open with two or three blues songs to get warmed up. You know, we did that a lot in Europe. We would play Jimmy Reed songs and stuff like that just to kind of get into the groove a little bit. So that music was very important to him as well.
Certainly. Now, you got a call to perform backup vocals on an album by Mr. Dickie Betts.
Yeah, I was living in Nashville and trying to make a living as a session musician and singer. I was 23 when I moved up there, and I got a call to sing background on what was going to be a Dickie Betts solo album, which I did, and they wound up not releasing the record, and it was, I think Dickie felt like it was too country, and he called me and said, hey, let's write some songs, let's go make a rock and roll record, and I think I was 26 at that point, and that was a huge opportunity for me. I spent the next 2 or 3 years with him writing and recording and touring, which eventually led to me joining the Allman Brothers.
Right. You co-wrote a tune for Greg Allman for one of his solo albums that year, didn't you?
Just Before the Bullets Fly was
right.
the title track of his solo record, and at the same time I was writing with Dickie, but Dickie and Greg were not performing together at that time, and there was no plans of an Allman Brothers reunion. So I just happened to coincidentally be writing for both camps. So when they decided to get back together, they brought me in not just as a guitar player, but as a singer and a songwriter as well.
Right. That was 89, I believe, the band decided to reunite. You had Mr. Neal on keyboards, Alan Woody on bass. And you've been on all the studio albums for the Allman Brothers.
From that point forward, yeah.
We
made 4 studio records and several live records. And, you know, it was an amazing opportunity for me.
Certainly. It has to be great to be a member of that storied Allman Brothers band. And you left the group with Alan Woody in 97 to focus solely on Government Mule.
Yeah, at that time, there was a lot of tension and friction in the Allman Brothers band. The original members were not getting along very well. There was no writing, no recording, no rehearsing. And in the Government Mule camp, it was the complete opposite. We were having fun and writing songs and recording, and it was very fertile. And so Alan Woody and myself decided that to take that next step and prove to ourselves and to the rest of the world that Government Mule was a full-time band, it meant leaving an institution like the Allman Brothers, which was a very hard decision, but I think the right one at that time.
Right. Now, was it the unfortunate death of Alan, did that bring you back to the Allman Brothers in 2000? Talk a little bit about that, Warren.
Yeah, absolutely. Woody passed away in 2000 unexpectedly, and I think had that not happened, neither he or I were thinking of looking backwards. You know, Government Mule was moving forward and getting bigger and better all the time. But when Alan passed away, for me, in my heart, I wasn't sure if Government Mule could continue. And we got a lot of encouragement, especially from friends and musicians that had lost band members, you know.
Right.
But it was a hard road ahead, and I got a call from Greg Allman saying, hey, I'd love to have you back in the band. And so I decided to go back with the Allman Brothers on a trial basis to see how it felt, how the music sounded. And in both cases, I was very pleasantly surprised. Everybody was getting along. Music sounded great. So that led to the next 14 years with that incarnation.
The rest, they say, is history. Right?
And a wonderful time.
Yeah. Now, the one thing that was added a long way in 2000 was the addition of Derek Trucks to the Allman Brothers Band. Talk a little bit about Derek and his influence and how you two coexist in the band.
Well, Derek and I have known each other since he was 11 years old.
Oh, okay.
We toured a lot together in the early days of Government Mule. The Derek Trucks Band would oftentimes be the opening act for Government Mule. So we played on stage dozens and dozens of times before we ever had the opportunity to play together in the Allman Brothers. When we found ourselves both in the Allman Brothers at the same time, he and I both were a little reluctant to be in a band with neither of the founding guitar players being there, because we're both such big fans of Duane Allman and Dickie Betts and mm-hmm. what they created together. But since that wasn't an option, we found ourselves in a challenging situation. And since both of us are Sly guitar players, we would kind of divide the duties and say, okay, well, I'm on this song, I'll play slide on that song, you play slide. And in some cases, we would even change that from night to night. There were certain songs where he would play slide one night, and the next time we played that song, I would play it, just to kind of keep things fresh and fun, you know. Derek and I have a wonderful working relationship and a wonderful personal relationship, and we were always just looking for ways to kind of keep the creative juices flowing.
Were you worried, Warren, at all about a comparison between Dickie Betts and Duane Allman about how they used to intertwine and feed off each other? Were you concerned about that at all?
No, I think going back to 89, when I first joined the band, that was a hot seat to be in.
Yeah.
And much more so than the 1 years down the road. But the fans were very embracing right from the very beginning, you know. And luckily, I was never expected to play more like Duane Allman or less like Duane Allman. You know, when the subject came up, the guys always said, we hired you to be you. You know, how much of Duane's influence you choose to show is your business. And so it was kind of a momentary decision on a nightly basis. And, of course, I'm such a big fan, I would automatically interject a lot of that influence. But I also would take advantage of the opportunities, especially in some of the longer, more improvisational pieces, to express myself in a different sort of way. And the fan was very accepting of that right from the beginning. I think largely because the chemistry we had in 1989 was so strong, and the fans were so glad to have the band back together, that it was all positive.
Definitely. Yeah, that's great that the fans were so accepting. That's really important. Now, by the end of 2014, the band decides to hang it up after, as you say, after 14 years together. How do you feel about that then?
Well, I think we'll all miss it, you know, and I always look forward to any time we can play together as a group or individually. You know, I played together with Greg recently, with Derek recently, with J-Mo recently, and, you know, the Allman Brothers was such a huge part of my life even before I knew those guys. They were always one of my favorite bands. I grew up learning that material, playing a lot of those songs in cover bands and bar bands. So actually being allowed to be part of that institution for 25 years was an incredible opportunity for me. But I think when I think back to 89, when I joined the band, the original members always talked about how the Allman Brothers wasn't a band that could just go through the motions and go play the hits, you know, like some yeah. nostalgia bands. And they always said when it started to look like a nostalgia act, it'd be time to quit. That conversation's been going on for 25 years. And it thankfully never reached that point, but I think we could all see it on the horizon. So for about 3 years, we were having discussions about making the 45th anniversary a good time to kind of stop touring. And you know, it's bittersweet, but I do agree with the decision.
Okay. Now, do you wish, Warren, though, that they had gone back in the studio and made another record before the end of the brothers?
I do, yeah. I think we should have made a final record. And I think everybody thinks that, but we just didn't all think it at the same time.
Yeah, unfortunately. We're speaking to Warren Haynes tonight on Sports Talk 1240. You toured now. We'll switch over to the Dead. Since the death of Jerry in 95, you've performed and toured with a lot of the surviving members, Bob Weir and Rob Wasserman, Phil Lesh and friends. The Jerry Garcia Art Orchestra is involved in that. Talk a little bit about your involvement with the Dead.
Well, my involvement started with Phil Lesh, the original bass player in the Grateful Dead, who called me in the late 90s and said that he had made a list of musicians that he would like to work with, and that I was someone on that list. He wanted to know if I would be willing to come out to California for a few days, rehearse a little bit, do a couple of shows, and see how it went. And I said, yeah, I would love to do that. And that began a wonderful relationship between Phil and myself, which led to me playing with the other guys, touring with the Dead in 2004 and in 2009. It was really a wonderful opportunity, you know, and to be on the inside of that music, you know, similar to being on the inside of the Allman Brothers music and seeing what makes it tick from the inside as opposed to just from a listener's standpoint was really great.
Now, in your solo career, Warren, you've collaborated with a lot of folks, Dave Matthews for one. Talk about some of the folks you've enjoyed playing with through the years.
Well, I've been very fortunate that I've been able to work with most of the people that I would put on that list if I were making a list. You know, the music business is a small world, so mm-hmm. we cross paths with all these people all the time. And so if a situation presents itself for me to perform or record or whatever with some of these folks, then I try and make sure that happens. In the case of Dave Matthews, we've known each other since they were mostly only known in the state of Virginia. You know, when they were just starting yeah. out, we became friends, and that friendship has stayed intact. And so fast forward all these years, our careers took different trajectories, but we've always played together whenever we get the opportunity, including me playing with them at Central Park, which was a highlight for 100,000 people, one of the greatest musical moments I've ever experienced.
Definitely, yeah, that was a great time. Your new album, Warren, let's get to that, Ashes and Dust. It's only your third studio album, but it's got a lot of songs on it that have been around for a while.
Yeah, I have continued to write songs in this direction all my life. It's coming from more of a singer-songwriter sort of direction. I've never felt like it was the right time to make this sort of record until recently. You know, I've been very fortunate to be involved in rock and roll bands like Government Mule and the Allman Brothers. And if I'm going to make a solo record, it usually means that I've written a batch of songs that I feel good about and that work together but don't seem like Allman Brothers songs or don't seem like Government Mule songs. And so that was the case with Man in Motion, my last solo record, and it's the case with this. Man in Motion was more like soul music meets blues, and Ashes and Dust is surrounded by acoustic instrumentation with a lot of Celtic and folk and kind of mountain music influence.
Right. A more folk-based approach, definitely. You brought in the New Jersey guys, Railroad Earth, as your collaborators for this project.
Well, they had opened for the Allman Brothers at Red Rocks, and I really enjoyed hearing them, and then we played together a little bit. And then the next few times we played together, it seemed like a very good, natural fit, so I thought it would be nice to go in the studio and record that way, and we had a blast. It was a really fun, organic process in the studio, and it came easy, and we didn't dwell on things. It was very nice.
Yeah, well, there's some great story songs on the album. You've collaborated with Phil Lesh. There's a tune that you co-wrote with Phil Lesh. Go ahead,
Song
Warren.
Spots of Time we wrote together, and actually the Allman Brothers were performing it live for a while and probably would have recorded it on that record you mentioned earlier had we made mm-hmm. that record.
And you've also got appearances by two of the brothers on the album.
Oteil Burbridge on bass and Mark Quinones on percussion. I brought them in for Spots of Time because I wanted to capture that on-stage experience that we had from playing the song so many times live. And combining that with the fact that the guys in Railroad Earth had never heard the song before, it's got this nice, spontaneous sort of blend.
Yeah, it does, definitely. Now, there's also collaborations with Grace Potter. You and her with a duet with Gold Dust Woman. Very, very, very beautiful.
Well, Grace and I had performed that live a few times, but never thought about recording it until I was making this record, and I thought it might be cool with the acoustic instrumentation. So I called her, and she seemed into the idea. So she dropped by the studio, and it turned out great.
And you also have Sean Colvin on the album.
Sean is singing harmony on the song Wanderlust, and I'm a big fan of her work. She sounds marvelous. And Mickey Raphael, who I've known over 30 years, the harmonica player in Willie Nelson's band, is playing harmonica on that same song. And so that's a nice kind of departure from the record as well.
Definitely sounds great. Now, I had read, Warren, originally some of the songs that you used for the album, you had originally planned for sessions with Levon Helm and Leon Russell to be done up in beautiful Woodstock.
We had been talking about making a record together with Levon and Leon Russell and a bass player named T-Bone Wolk, who I really loved. And T-Bone passed away, and then Levon passed away, so that record never came to fruition. Some of these songs we would have done on that record, although differently, because with the different personalities and different instrumentation, they would have automatically turned out differently. But I was really excited about that. We were going to record it at Levon's studio, and he and I had become really good friends, and I'm just always been a huge fan. I regret that record never happened, but these songs came to fruition later in a way that I really love.
Right. Yeah, Levon is certainly missed. You're a big fan, Warren, of First Takes. You believe in that, and the great quote that I read that you believe in is from B.B. King. Tell us that.
Well, I think you were referring to mistakes in music. Don't be scared of making mistakes. All the best performances contain mistakes, and when you remove the mistakes from music, you kind of remove the life and the magic, you know. And he always said that if he didn't make a bunch of mistakes in any given night, then it probably wasn't a very good night.
Yeah, exactly. Now, how do you go about writing a song, Warren?
Well, I guess it's different for everybody, and it's different for me with every song. The majority of my songs start out with a lyric. I get a lyrical idea, and as I start jotting it down, usually a melody will start coming into my head or some sort of rhythm. And so it all kind of starts happening at the same time. With some of the more up-tempo songs, maybe I'll get an idea from a guitar riff or something. But more often than not, the lyric comes first.
Okay. Now, recently you were inducted into the North Carolina Music Hall of Fame. That had to be a thrill for you.
Unbelievable. I mean, with people like John Coltrane and Thelonious Monk and Doc Watson and Earl Scruggs and, you know, James Taylor.
It's right.
Just, I'm still not quite sure how that happened.
Great honor regardless, though.
Absolutely, yeah.
Now you're going to do Conan O'Brien's show, when is that, Monday night?
Yeah, that's tomorrow.
Right, okay, so folks can watch out for Warren on Conan O'Brien. Tell us a little bit about the Christmas Jam and why you do that and who's coming up this year.
Well, the Christmas Jam is a charity show that I started 27 years ago in my hometown of Asheville, North Carolina. I always tell people it's not a jam and it's not a Christmas show. That's just the name of the event.
Nobody's going to come out and sing White Christmas, right?
Right. There's only been two or three Christmas songs in 27 years. But it started as an excuse for the local musicians to get together and play music at the one time a year that we all seemed to be home, which was the Christmas holidays. And we would, you know, make a small amount of money and donate it to charity, and each year it got a little bigger and a little bigger. And then people like Derek Trucks and Alan Woody and Toy Caldwell from the Marshall Tucker Band and Bobby Keys from the Rolling Stones and Kevin Kinney and Edwin McCain started coming. And it was becoming more than just a local event. Then one year, Derek Trucks' guitar got stolen out of the dressing room, and my wife, Stephanie, said, "That's it. We're not doing it in the clubs anymore. We're moving it to a bigger venue." And so we would start making phone calls early in the year, inviting friends and musicians and artists that we had relationships with. And it's just grown and grown and grown and grown. We've been working with Habitat for Humanity now for almost 20 years, and I think we've built 33 houses.
Wow.
And they're a wonderful organization. I'm proud to be associated with them.
Certainly. Great cause, great show. Now, also, you're coming back to New York New Year's Eve.
Yes. Two nights at the Beacon Theater, which has kind of become tradition for Government Mule. And we're very excited about that. I've played the Beacon Theater more than any venue, any other venue in the world.
I bet. Yeah, you have. Talk a little bit about the Beacon, and you enjoy it.
Well, the guys in the original guys in the Allman Brothers always say that it reminds them of the original Fillmore East, which I was too young to have ever seen.
Right.
Of course, a lot of my favorite records were made there. The Beacon is just a wonderful audience. It's the perfect size, you know, 3,000 people. Mm-hmm. So it's not too big. It's not too small. It looks great. It sounds great. It's just got a wonderful vibe. And so I've just had so many amazing show experiences there. I always look forward to being back.
Sure. New York City Government Mule New Year's Eve at the Beacon. Check that out, folks. Well, Warren, it's been a real pleasure having you with us tonight. Talking about your great career. The new album's called Ashes and Dust. I thank you, Warren, for taking time out of your Sunday evening to be with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Take care. Warren Haynes, ladies and gentlemen. Next up, we'll talk to Russ Cohen about his new book, Numbers Don't Lie, The Biggest Numbers in New York Mets History on Sports Talk 1240. Stay with us, folks.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240, right here on Long Island's AM 1240 WGBB. Be sure and visit us online at sportstalk1240.com.
Hey, fantasy sports fans. DraftPot has an exclusive offer for Sports Talk 1240 listeners. Sign up today at DraftPot.com with the promo code SPORTSTALK1240, and DraftPot will match 100% of your first deposit up to $1,500. That's right. Sign up today at DraftPot.com with the promo code SPORTSTALK1240, and DraftPot will match 100% of your first deposit up to $1,500. What are you waiting for? Do it now.
Country Foot Care, official podiatrists of the New York Lizards, have been delivering state-of-the-art foot care with good old-fashioned caring to Long Island residents for over 30 years. Specialists in sports medicine and foot injuries, Country Foot Care can be reached at 516-741-FEET or online at countryfootcare.com.
Unflippable, unflappable, unleakable. The Gustbuster is the only umbrella that won't flip inside out, rip, tear, or leak. Capable of withstanding winds over 55 miles per hour. All of our umbrellas are constructed of the finest quality materials and backed by a limited lifetime guarantee. What are you waiting for? Visit GustBuster.com and get your GustBuster today.
Whether you're a couple enjoying a romantic meal for two, a family wanting to dine in a relaxed and friendly setting, or a larger party wanting to celebrate a special occasion, Miller Place Pastoria always combines a warm welcome with the finest contemporary Italian cuisine and wines. Also serving up Long Island's favorite pizza. We're located right on Route 25A in Miller Place. Come visit us today and check us out online at mppastoria.com.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240, broadcasting every Sunday night beginning at 8 p.m. right here on Long Island's AM 1240 WGBB, the station that serves your community. And now, back to the show.
All right, we're back with Sports Talk 1240 on WGBB, Freeport, New York. Bill Donahue with you. I hope you had a great weekend. Big football Sunday today. Jets couldn't get it done, though. We're on the brink of the Fall Classic. The Kansas City Royals will be welcoming the Mets into Kauffman Stadium on Tuesday night. And most of all, I hope you're enjoying Sports Talk 1240 tonight. Well, my next guest, sports journalist whose work has appeared in numerous places, including FoxSports.com and NHL.com. He's the author of Baseball's Best Rookies, Strike Three, and the Winter Classic, The NHL Savior. Now he's co-authored a book with Adam Rader entitled Numbers Don't Lie, The Biggest Numbers in New York Mets History. I welcome to Sports Talk 1240 tonight, Russ Cohen. Russ, good evening.
Hey, good evening, Bill.
Great to have you with us, Russ.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Explain the premise behind the book for the folks.
Premise behind the book is Triumph had come up with a concept, and the concept was basically, hey, let's try and trace some of the great numbers for teams throughout their history. And they were having a little bit of a time deciding who to start with. And we had just finished up a New York Ranger book, and they said, hey, we're doing this baseball book. We understand, Russ, that you're a big baseball guy. And they floated that it could be the Mets or another team. And I said, well, you know, I'm a lifelong Met fan, so I'll do it regardless. And then it turned into the Mets. And I'm really glad because the book has a lot of graphs and pie charts and just nice anecdotal statistical information that back up our chapter. So it's a really fun read, and it's one of those that you could pick up, read a chapter a night, and it would go very quickly.
It sure does. Now, the foreword, folks, to the book is written by the great Howard Johnson, and he has a great quote about the book itself, saying, numbers don't lie, but they also don't tell the whole story. And that's really what the book is about, isn't it, Russ?
Right, and that is really what it's about. You know, you have the numbers, but then we do back it up with the story, and Howard really does bring you into the locker room in 1986. We all think we know everything that went on there, and if you get the book, you'll see that, you know, even more things went on there that we didn't realize. So it's nice to sort of see it through the eyes of a player, and he's just such a well-respected, good guy. All Met fans love him, and so it was a big thrill to get him to work on this.
Yeah, I bet it was. Now, let's go through some of the numbers. Let's start at the bottom. Well, actually, the book starts with percentages, fielding percentages, batting averages, and then we get to zero. Let's talk about zero, Russ.
Well, you know, you have to start somewhere,
right?
And so, if you want to start at zero, that's fine. It's this guy Steve Chilcott. He got picked after Reggie Jackson, picked before Reggie Jackson. Sorry, by the New York Mets. And the interesting thing was, and Reggie basically had told the Mets he didn't want to play for him. So in 1966, when the Mets drafted, they went with this other guy, Steve Chilcott. He played zero major league games.
Right.
You know, and it's hard to kill the Mets on this one because, you know, they've had this happen twice in their existence that I know about, one with Reggie and one with Mark McGuire. Like, Mark McGuire went up to him and said, you can't afford me, so don't bother. And so they didn't draft him. And so, yeah, this is a big zero, but it's, you know, it's a footnote in Mets history.
It sure is. Steve Chilcott. And in a way, you could say it's typical Mets, the way they draft Steve Chilcott ahead of Reggie Jackson. But that's number zero. And I remember this day here, number 10, Russ. Came home from school, turned on the TV, and there was Tom Terrific.
Yeah, Tom Seaver, I mean, he's my favorite player of all time. I mean,
oh, yeah, I agree.
Mean, everybody in my neighborhood, it's kind of funny. I grew up in North Massapequa, and everybody would have the argument, who was better, Tom Seaver or Vida Blue at the time? Vida Blue was the good argument. But, you know, Seaver did have a game where he struck out 19 and struck out 10 in a row for a major league record. That 10 in a row got challenged this year, but not tied and not broken.
Right.
And it's held up all this time. And I remember I may have watched it as a kid. I may not have, hard to say. I may have listened to it on the radio. But years later, I did get a cassette of this game. And you wouldn't believe how loud the crowd got when he kept striking out these guys because, you know, you think 10 strikeouts in a row is not that big a deal, and guys like Clemens and other great pitchers have gotten close to it. I think Kershaw was the one this year. But the funny thing is just someone could foul out. Someone could walk.
Sure.
Anything. It's just so many, you know, you don't really think about the randomness of it, but it's a record that's held all these years.
You talk about the noise of the crowd, too, Russ. Now, that was a weekday day game. A lot of day games back in those days when I was a kid. A lot of weekday day games, and for a crowd to be that noisy during the week, it's something special's got to be going on. We've had I believe the 10th guy, and then the final strikeout was Al Ferrara. Used to play for the Dodgers and later went to the San Diego Padres. He's been a guest on the show.
Oh, nice.
And had him speaking about that. So pretty impressive.
And again, 10 in a row. It happened in 1970. It's still going on as far as an active record. People want to sometimes say, hey, it wasn't a great lineup. You know, we point out, hey, there still was Cito Gaston and Nate Colbert. So they did have a good lineup. And I like the way that Triumph sort of broke down his pitches, how many fastballs, how many sliders, how many curveballs. That kind of stuff I always find interesting after the fact.
And something that really wasn't kept back then too closely. Very interesting to see, and that takes place in this book as well. A lot of stats, a lot of little side notes that the Met fan would enjoy. Now, one item, Russ, that number 14 that people may not remember or may not be aware about is Felix Mian striking out only 14 times.
You know, it's funny. We all used to sort of emulate him playing wiffle ball because it seemed like...
Oh, yeah.
It seemed like he was holding 45% of the bat, and 55% was going through the other, through the bottom. And it was pretty close to a 50-50 split the way he batted, and it was hard to hit that way.
Yeah.
Like if you tried to do it, it was very hard to hit that way. But he knew how to do it, and, boy, was he a contact hitter. You know, he would get his extra base hits, too. He never really got home runs, once in a blue moon. But, you know, he would get his doubles and triples, but... if you needed him up in a big spot, he could get a hit. And nowadays, I think he would be a very revered player because we all marvel anytime with pitch counts what they are. We all marvel like when, you know, David Wright recently had that at bat where he had like 20 pitches, right? And we all said, wow, what an at bat that was. Mian did that all the time.
He did, yeah. It was habitual with Felix.
Didn't matter back then.
Yeah. And as you say, always had the bat on the ball.
As
evidence, the 14 strikeouts.
It's tremendous. It'll never happen again, obviously. Guys strike out 100 times in half the game.
Right. Well, one thing that latter-day Met fans may remember, Russ, is Robin Ventura's Grand Slam single, and that comes in with number 15.
Yeah, the Grand single is a big deal. You mentioned baseball's best rookies, and Howie Carpen actually was there. He didn't score that game, although he's the Mets' official scorer, but he was around for that. And it really it's kind of an amazing thing because you didn't quite grasp what was happening at the time. You really didn't. It was like, wait a minute, why is it game over? Why didn't he score? Why anything? You know, it's kind of like a crazy moment in time, but it was nice because, hey, it was in Game 5 in the NLCS. It was nice because it was against the Braves, and Met fans were suffering anytime they played the Braves. So this was just a really, really great moment in time that everybody's always going to remember.
Definitely. Now, if I'm not mistaken, Russ, you correct me if I'm wrong, it was Todd Pratt who stopped Robin Ventura.
Yes.
And it's ironic that Todd Pratt was allowed to run the bases on his home run.
Right. And for whatever reason, Pratt did do that. And then, yeah, when he hit the one against the Diamondbacks, you're absolutely right.
He went around the bases unencumbered.
Yes.
Now, let's move up to number 25, a 25-inning game that folks may not remember.
Yeah, that's one that goes way back. I mean, for whatever reason, the Mets seem to always have these long extra-inning games when I was a kid. And in September of 74, they had one against the Cardinals. And it's just one of those that back then you didn't have the same sort of restrictions from the Players Association, time limits, all those things. And this game started at 8 o'clock, and it ended at 3:13 in the morning.
Amazing.
I mean, the Mets lost. You know, guys like Joe Torre played, you know, Jerry Kuzman. It was pretty great. There was the sixth longest game at the time. And right now, actually, not at the time, but now. And so it's fun to just go back and read about guys like that. You know, there's a guy in that game, Ken Reitz,
Ken Reitz, yeah.
Now, what's interesting about him is he hit a two-run homer in that game, but the thing that I always remembered about Ken Reitz was he was one of those guys that was always ripping it up early in the season and was always in the league leaders, many times was leading the league in hitting, and then the second half would just, you know, totally dissolve, and he'd end up hitting, you know, like 270. And that's what I sort of always remember about Ken Reitz. This game, I definitely, you know, would not have been allowed to stay awake for. Now, it doesn't mean I didn't have it on my transistor radio because I was pretty good at that. But, yeah, 25 innings, and they lost. I guess, for whatever reason, 1,000 people stayed.
Yeah.
Which is crazy, right? Because out of the 13,000, whatever they announced, 1,000 people stayed for 25 innings. That's something.
They obviously didn't have to get up the next morning.
Yeah, well, I guess that's really the
case. Yeah, we're speaking to Russ Cohen tonight about his book, Numbers Don't Lie, The Biggest Numbers in New York Mets History. We'll stick with futility for a moment, Russ, and go to number 27. Good old Anthony Young.
Yeah, Anthony Young, and we all know he was a better pitcher than this record denotes, but it's just, it's one of those things you feel bad because over the streak, he still had 12 straight saves. You know, there were things he did during that time that you say, wow, he was a pretty good pitcher. But
yeah,
he still ended up losing. And it's just one of those records that went over more than 1 year and will probably never get broken. I mean, I really have a hard time thinking it's going to get broken. But, you know, by the end of June, he was 0-10.
Yeah.
Which is
amazing.
Which is crazy when you think about it.
Yeah.
If you were to watch this guy pitch, and you would have been like, this guy's a pretty good pitcher. How does this even happen? But it's just the way it just one of those things that happen, you know? I mean,
It's the Mets.
I mean, and he even had a 23 2/3 consecutive scoreless streak over this time too.
Yeah. Not shabby, and yet he pitched well enough to lose. Good old Anthony Young.
He pitched well enough
yeah.
to lose.
Yeah.
It's a great quote.
Yeah.
It's a great quote. I love it.
Bob Murphy, let's number 42. You talk about imitating Felix Mian when we were kids playing ball in the backyard. I used to imitate Bob Murphy here at Shea Stadium selling the
That's
Mets yearbook 11368, you know, and
yeah.
Talk a little bit about Murph and his years behind the mic, Russ.
Yeah, I remember I went to Bob Murphy Day, and he retired in 2003, but he was sort of like the soundtrack of my childhood.
Yeah.
Going from, it always seemed like on the weekends I was always going to visit relatives in Brooklyn, and so we'd go from Long Island to Brooklyn, and we'd be stuck in the car, and the only saving grace from that being the most miserable trip was listening to Bob Murphy. We all agreed that we should be listening to the Met game, and so Murph was great, the happy recaps and all that. But he really had a great career. I mean, you know, he worked with Kirk Gowdy. I mean, that's
mm-hmm.
a heck of a name.
Right.
He actually called Maris's 60th homer. I mean, you know, that's a pretty great achievement. And everybody sort of liked, even when he was getting older and got a little grumpy, you know, and got a little, we talked about that, where he got a little grumpy on the air, too, and with Gary Cohen. And I always wondered, I don't know if that was Bob getting older or Bob not wanting to sort of relinquish the job that was definitely going to go to Gary.
Interesting
point.
What
was your
yeah.
feeling on that?
I think it's just getting a little grumpy.
Okay.
I had an instance I don't know if you remember, and if the folks know, on the press level at Shea Stadium, there was a corridor that ran behind all the booths.
Right.
And I went down there one day to try to talk to Bob, and he was in the midst of a little furor, you know, and I was just like Homer Simpson. I was like, ah, and I ran the other way, you know. You don't want to see Bob Murphy, you know, in his imitable style, cursing and yelling and stuff like that. So, In the same vein, it made me feel that my hero was human, but also it kind of shocked me in a way.
Yeah, I could see that. I mean, he had the memorable call of Buckner. He had the memorable call of Seaver's almost perfect game, which I actually have a a painting of. It's not really a painting, but it's more like a litho. And then that's kind of a cool thing because you see the old Longines clock. And
right.
Really, if you think about it, Seaver, and I don't have the number, I forget, but he's somewhere in the top five or six for one hitters in his career. And so, of course, you know, until Johan, which is in the book as well, the we all remembered that game, the Jimmy Quails, and just the, how terrible that was.
What a night, yeah.
And so somebody actually, you know, memorialized that in a picture. And so, but I kind of like it because there's things on there that, you know, there's no advertising. There's, I like the out-of-town scoreboard, the way it was, the blandness of it, the RC Cola stuff. So, you know, we all harken back to that and sort of like those times.
We never forget the Bob Murphy. They won the damn thing 10-9, too.
Yeah.
That was that was one of Merv's classics. Well, we'll move on to number 45, Russ. This was one of my favorites, the 45 seasons at Shea Stadium.
Yeah. I mean, say what you want about Shea Stadium, but I really did love the place. I was probably, you know, one of the happiest days for me was when they got rid of the wooden seats and switched to the plastic.
I remember it. Do you remember the colors of the wooden seats?
I want to say it was like a weird blue. It wasn't like a Met blue, but I want to say it was sort of like a weird blue, or green. I can't remember.
The green was the upper deck. The mezzanine was the blue, and each level had two different shades to disseminate from the box section and the regular section. So you had green in the upper deck. You had blue in the mezzanine.
Okay.
The loge was a type of tannish brown. And, of course, the box seats in those days that you could see from a lot of the old baseball cards were yellow.
Right. There's a lot of cool pictures that, for whatever reason, when Shea was closing and I was at that last game and we all said goodbye and, of course, to another bad season, no playoffs, all that.
But yeah.
There were a lot of great pictures that came out, like when Shea first opened. You know, they broke ground in 61, and then there was just, like, a lot. They did a lot back in the day, aerial shots. And we forget that was a pretty cool stadium, pretty amazing stadium back in the day. I mean,
it was beautiful when I remember going there about 1966 or 7, Russ.
Okay.
And I tell you, they had colored lights on the white part of the scoreboard that would go on and off.
Were the escalators working, Bill?
Yes, they were in those days, yes. And the bathrooms were fine, as I recall. I didn't have to wear hip waders or anything.
Okay.
But, yeah, I got my own batting helmet that night. And, of course, the green grass, when you came through the ramp and up the little ramp there to check out the field for the first time, I'll never forget that sight of the lights and the green grass at Shea.
Yeah, the cost was, you know, very low back then, between $28.5 and $31 million, where Citi Field cost $850 million in comparison. So,
oh, boy, yeah.
But it again, and I'll tell you, it goes back to I play softball. I'm an avid softball player, and we were playing this year, and for some reason a plane flew overhead. Now, I was playing in Philadelphia, so nowhere near any of this. And I didn't realize at the time the guy pitching for my team grew up in New York. And I found out just that day, actually, just before the game. And while that happened, after he told me that, he looked at me like, uh-oh, this is like a Shea Stadium moment. He didn't have to say a word. Because we both saw a plane flying overhead, and that was exact. It just seemed like, well, there were probably four or five or six every game.
Yeah, oh, more than that.
More than that. And you were trying to talk to someone, and then all of a sudden the plane would...
And it would really unnerve some of the visiting ball players. I remember, I think it was Rusty Staub saying he used to step out.
Yep. And I did, you know, look, we saw some great concerts there. I saw the Police Sting. Police. It was the Police, Joan Jett, and R.E.M. But I was in the parking lot having some fun with Frisbee and adult beverages during R.E.M., and I didn't see R.E.M., and I probably should have seen them, but the Police were really good. I felt Joan Jett was the best of the night, to be honest, but that was a great night because that was a great triple bill at Shea Stadium.
Never forget stuff like that. I mean, the Who.
The
Beatles, of course, with the most memorable concert of all time, took place at Shea Stadium. Yeah. Well, one thing in the book, folks, that you'll enjoy, and I really enjoyed going through, in number 45 for the 45 years at Shea. We're 45 things we'll never forget about Shea Stadium. And I tell you, Russ, some of those are classic. Like you talk about the wooden seats. You talk about the anticipation of the 7 train pulling into Willets Point. Willie Mays, pink Chrysler Imperial.
I remember as a kid seeing that.
Not many people remember that. Willie Mays folks used to drive to the ballpark at Shea Stadium in a pink Chrysler Imperial. And, of course, you know what the license plate said.
Yeah. And he parked it right out, you know, outside of the outfield, outside of the area. Like, you knew where that area was.
Yeah.
My dad would point it out to me. And my dad was a big Willie Mays fan, and therefore, I was a big Willie Mays fan. And so that was kind of a thrill. Like, when, you know, I went to Willie Mays Day as a kid, you know, and he seemed to sign an autograph for everybody in Shea Stadium, like everybody.
Which is rare, probably, because Willie's turned into kind of a bitter guy.
I know.
His license plate used to read, "Say hey, folks," of course, for those who were hanging on that statement.
In case you didn't know.
Yeah. Of course.
Saturday doubleheader. I got to tell you, I'm married for 27 years, but I went on a date for Banner Day doubleheader. And my wife swears she would never go again, not only to a Banner Day, but a Banner Day doubleheader, because you're not talking about just like a day at the ballpark. You're really talking about 8 hours.
It's a marathon, yeah.
It's a marathon.
Between the two games and the Banner Day in between. Amazing. And they used to me, I recall doubleheaders almost every Sunday back in those days.
Oh, yeah, they were. And my grandfather would take me to a ton of them. And my grandmother, you know, again, no cell phones. Nobody was calling from the ballpark. So it was just sort of like, how did my grandmother know when to start dinner? She would have to watch. Like, she had no choice. Even if she didn't want to, she had to have an idea when these games were going to end.
Definitely. And several other things. You could always bribe an usher at Shea to move you to a better seat. They were always looking for a tip, too, back in those days, where they don't accept tips these days at Citi Field, which is kind of weird.
It is, because we grew up with that system, so we feel like it's normal.
Yeah. Here's $5. Get me down to the box seats, you know?
Right.
And,
although $5 wouldn't have done it. It was like a $20.
Yeah, I would have stayed in the mezzanine for that money, Russ.
Loads.
Yeah. Yeah. Now you talk about other things. The traffic on the Van Wyck, which was always horrendous. Taking a sip out of your first beer at Shea Stadium was a big rite of passage in those days.
It was, but, you know, it was probably like a Schaefer or a Rheingold.
Yeah, we weren't talking Heineken, folks, or anything, or Stella Artois, you can today. You can go and get a vanity beer at Citi Field.
You can get like one of the Guinness that I actually could get in Ireland. You can get like a Murphy's that has a mixing bowl. You can get all of that back then. Schaefer or Rheingold. That's it.
That's it. Yeah, with the plastic over the top.
Yes.
Yeah, that was a big attraction back in those days.
It was.
Now, 82. People may not realize 82 wins with the Mets going to the World Series this year with 90 wins. Talk a little bit about what 82 wins means, Russ.
Yeah, 1973 was a big year in the whole "You Gotta Believe" campaign with Tug McGraw, basically after coming out of a team meeting, just saying, hey, you know, he still believed in the club. And this was after N. Donald Grant basically called a meeting to see what the heck was wrong with these guys. And they went on a tear. You know, they went on a 49-22 run. That really is incredible for any day standards. But it really is incredible that they only had 82 wins and didn't have to go through all of these other rounds to get to the NLCS, right? They just got there. But it was a great team. Some people may not remember that Rusty Staub threw out his shoulder.
Right.
At some
actually
point.
Crashed into the wall.
That's right.
Yeah,
he crashed into the wall, and he was throwing underhand. I was 10, and I remember him throwing underhand. And it's like, that just struck me as, wow, like this guy's playing to the point where he will just throw underhand to stay in the game. And they would just go out there and make sure they had the cutoff. You know, I remember Willie Mays
Poor Willie, yeah. Looking kind of pathetic in the outfield, ironic. Because Willie always said that he criticized Mickey Mantle for sticking around too long. Yeah. And it's ironic that Willie Mays sort of did the same thing.
Yeah. The late, great Yogi Berra, I always felt like he got a bad rap because, listen, if Tom Seaver wants to move up and pitch on short rest rather than throw George Stone, I'm going to go with Tom Seaver on short rest every time.
Yeah, you have to.
You have to. And look, Stone went anyhow and got racked, right?
Right.
So, like, at the end of the day, I think Yogi made the right call. And I remember years ago when I met his granddaughter, Lindsay, who I've become good friends with, it was one of the first things I told her. I said, look, I don't hold a grudge. I thought he did the right thing. That's exactly what any team should do, is go with their ace. And if it doesn't happen, it doesn't happen. But it was really a magical year. And it was one of those years where how could they beat the big red machine? It's impossible, right? I mean, that looked like an impossibility. With everybody that
two legendary powerhouse ball clubs, with that Cincinnati Red Club and the Oakland A ball club, with many Hall of Famers on both sides.
Yeah, the Oakland A one, I remember I got an early glimpse of them that year. Believe it or not, I won like a contest at Carvel, and I won free tickets to Mets Yankees, so I got to go to Yankee Stadium and against that team. And they hit back-to-back-to-back homers, and it was like Bando, Tennis, and Jackson. And they were just tremendous. And so that team, the Mets had no business taking them as far as they did, honestly.
Definitely.
But the pitching did it, and timely hitting.
Certainly. And the book is called Numbers Don't Lie, the biggest numbers in New York Mets history. Such nice nuggets as how much does the apple weigh, folks? Get the book and find out. Well,
that's right.
I tell you, Russ, it's been a pleasure having you with us tonight. Thanks for taking the time out of your Sunday night to be with us.
I appreciate it, Bill. It was a lot of fun.
Take care, Russ. Russ Cohen, folks. That'll do it for me tonight on Sports Talk 1240. I'd like to thank my guests, Warren Haynes and Russ Cohen, and you for joining us. Stay tuned for Hour 2 on Sports Talk 1240. I'll be back with you next Sunday, November 1st. Till then, Bill Donahue wishing you good evening, folks.
The views expressed in the previous program did not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.